I'm very glad that I'm here and was given the opportunity by the organizers to have an extended stay here. I'm maybe a little bit an odd animal here because my background is really not at all AMO physics, but condensed matter physics. I try to make up by having a catchy title, but when I talk about molecules, what I really mean is some stick having a dipole moment. I really am not too familiar with molecular physics yet. That is also why I'm very happy that I'm here and get some ideas how to incorporate maybe a little bit more AMO physics into our condensed matter methods, which I will present now, mostly results, but also try to explain a little bit how our methods work, since it's a theory workshop. So I want to start with maybe two things that got me interested in the field of cold gases. One was the question of rotons in dilute systems. What are rotons? They're not rotating, they're just local minima in the dispersion relation of a collective excitation spectrum. And this is what I mean. I'll come back to this picture, but this is the momentum in some units and energy in some units, and you see here local minimum. That's the roton. It has been known since many decades to appear in helium-4, where it's just a signature of a very dense system where you start to see kind of short range near order. Helium is very dense. It's not solid yet at zero temperature and zero pressure, but it's very dense, so there's a near ordering, and this leads to a roton. The typical wave number, or the typical line, wave number is basically related to the average nearest neighbor distance. So the wavelength is just the average neighbor distance, essentially. So you see already why how this is related to near order, short range order. And if you comp oh, sorry. Okay, I tried. So you can see if you compare with the phono dispersion in the crystal, maybe I sketch it, looks, for example, something like this. And I don't know if everybody can see because of the screen. Here you have pi over the lattice constants, but you could continue. And then it goes down and up again. And you can think of this as something like a roton. It's not really, but it's just a trivial fact that wave vectors beyond the first baryon zone are equivalent to wave vectors within the baryon zone. But you can think of the roton as something like as approaching the lattice order. No. So this is the sound wave, phonons.
Yeah.
I mean, when you have interactions, there are always sound waves. And then this one is the roton. So, and in helium, this is how the dispersion looks like and has been measured many times, and it's well known. Yeah, it would have the crystal structure. I mean, it would go down to zero again, but it's because of it's a trivial fact of the symmetry of a crystal. I mean, really, all the wave numbers beyond the first baryon zone are equivalent to one within the baryon zone. I mean, people look then at the possibility, well, what if you increase the pressure on helium? Shouldn't then the energy go down? And it does go down of the roton. And well, maybe eventually it touches zero, but this has never been observed. It crystallizes before this happens. In simulations, you can go well beyond the crystallization. You just keep it liquid and increase the density, but this never happens. It always it moves with the pressure, but it never goes to zero. Then in several years ago now, the people actually found something very similar dispersions in cold gases using mean field calculation, Kospidevsky calculations. They looked at a layer. So let's consider a layer of a dipolar gas. I mean, and everybody knows this here, in a 1D trap. So it's infinite in two directions, and you can associate the wave number with that in that direction. And it has some finite extent in the z direction. The polarization shall be fixed in the z direction. And then you have excitation modes, which have a wave number, parallel momentum. There are several modes, perpendicular modes, but we are only interested in the lowest mode. And then there were several calculations. I show one example. They got dispersions relations like this, which looks very similar to people like us have been used to rotons, to helium, in helium.
In 1D
means the trap is 1D. That's always the question, what means 1D. It's a 1D trap, which means it's confined in one direction and infinite in the two other directions. So it's a plane of a finite thickness. Quasi 2D, I call it, but some people say this is not the proper word, I'm not sure. This can happen at any density, so it clearly must be a very different kind of photon that is than in helium, where it's related to the strong interaction, the strong correlations at short distance. So I will just, when I talk about this different kind of photon, this in a cold gases, I consider as a photon number two. And in helium, or in any system where it's made by the strong repulsion at short distances, I call it rotor number one. And another thing that got me interested in the field was calculations where it was shown that dipolar system at reasonable densities can become very strongly correlated. And that's now a let's assume we still have the layer, but we crank up the confinement sufficiently that we can consider it as two-dimensional. Then we get, if we then also use this typical dipolar units, length is measured by MD squared, essentially, and then the energy also by according units. There's a very simple Hamiltonian, right? This is trivial. The only parameter we have is now the density, essentially. And then people have looked at if this two-dimensional dipolar Bose gas can solidify, and usually it's referred to as self-assembled lattice, because in the cold gas community you have the optical lattices, and a solid would be a self-assembled lattice without external potential, which also means that you have phonon modes and everything that you have in a solid. And they calculated the critical density where this is happening. It's clear that since this is quite repulsive, a short distance, this should happen. It's this trivial effect if you play billiard and you put your billiard balls into this triangular shape, it's a solid because of the repulsion. So it's not really a mystery that this solidifies at high density. It's just solid state physics in a sense. The important thing is that, as you all know, especially for molecular dipoles, this distance R0, the length scale, can be very large, and I think this is the most extreme case. It's really basically macroscopic dipole lengths, tens of a millimeter. I don't know if this is under consideration, but in any case, for all the molecules that are currently being tried to cooled and achieve maybe Bose-Einstein condensation or higher phase-based densities, it's always in the range of thousands of nanometers or at least hundreds of nanometers. So it's a very large length. And according to Monte Carlo simulations, this critical density is around 290 if I measure it in dipolar units. And if you plug in these two numbers, you see that these densities are not terribly high. maybe at the moment cannot be achieved, probably, because otherwise they would have seen this, but it's really a fairly low density system. But because of the large dipole lengths, it's actually very strongly interacting and becomes a solid. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. And it's. Yes, I think Brendan just assumed a field of 10 kilovolt, which I think is not unreasonable, and you get about 60% polarization, right, for this extreme case of SRO, which is already. Well, well, then it would mean that this is maybe the density has to be slightly higher. I mean, well, if you mean, what do you mean other way? If they are all uniformly polarized, I think they will essentially repel each other.
Yeah, exactly.
But the question. That's a question we are actually starting to study this week, mostly Brendan Evelyn's, because we also wonder, I kept wondering since I started this, why basically everybody assumes classical dipole sticks and without rotational degrees of freedom. And Brendan calculated, is it 60% of the dipole, average dipole moment is 60% of the bare dipole moment at 10 kilovolt for this. This has a very large dipole moment of 9 something dBi. Well, we can double check again. But it's true, I mean, it's an interesting question that we are studying. That's how I also see it. But there is a kind of a zero point motion around this. And what we want to check now is this important? Is this even stable? What people have calculating in Monte Carlo, and we mostly Brendan implemented now. I would have come to at the end of my talk to this, but if you include in Monte Carlo the rotational degrees of freedom and apply an actual field, then everything, all degrees of freedom are taken into account. And we will now repeat these kind of things, including this effect. And if we are unlucky, we get the same results. And if you're lucky, we see there's maybe a big change, at least in some parameter regions. Well, maybe it's not. I mean. No, but if you are preparing in a ground state in an electric field, there's a finite probability to be not oriented, right? And that's what I call zero point motion. So this, the Hamiltonian. Well, we. Yeah. just the fact that not necessarily. Even if the weak the field is not that strong compared to B, you will have an average orientation, but the you have a finite probability to sample all orientations. So basically, you're simply solving the problem of a particle in this potential, right? And this is the orientation. And your ground state wave function will be something like this, away from the zero, from the Z orientation. And I don't know how else to explain it. That's all what I meant. 100% polarization means angle equal to zero, Z direction. Yes, yes. Well, I'm not completely sure if I understand, but I mean, it's certainly at very large distance separation, then yes, you see only the average dipole moment. But I mean, this is. I mean, the density is much closer than the dipole length, much shorter if you're in a solidified state. A 20th of the dipole length. It's probably still smaller than B, but I'm not saying that you see you necessarily see something like a complete change of the phase, but you can. I think it's not. It could be that you see some, for example, smaller average polarization because of the interaction. Okay, maybe it turns out to be that way. It's in the lower state of a dipole in an electric field. So, for example, if the field is strong, it's a kind of a harmonic oscillator state. Or yeah, in the angle. So this would be the potential, And if it's strong, then you can approximate it by harmonic oscillator, then you have some Gaussian. Okay, so but now let's go back to the aligned dipoles, the approximation where I consider them as classical sticks with an average dipole moment. Okay. So I think I can skip this slide because everybody knows about various experiments running in various labs. And the overview is really a different kind of systems, which yeah, we looked at, and I just characterized them maybe by the kind of potential we are using. And the simplest one, which I already talked about, is it's perfectly polarized and two-dimensional. Then I showed already the potential, just 1 over r to the third. You don't see anything of the anisotropy because you restrict the particles really to a plane. That has been studied a few years ago already with quantum Monte Carlo. You can also tilt the angle. Then you can see something of the anisotropy. You get then two-dimensional system with an interaction which is different in two directions. You have an anisotropic interaction. And that's simply this one. And let's go back to, well, and you can have them polarized but in three dimensions. Then you have this kind of interaction. But we always consider quasi two-dimensional system. So it's three-dimensional, but it's restricted in the third direction to approximately harmonic oscillator. Or you can completely look at unpolarized systems, and then you might or might not have an effect. And according to you, there's no effect if you include, if you allow for rotational degrees of freedom. And I remember again, the units are, I show all in units of dipole length and this dipole energy. So density is always measured also in dipole units. Let's go to methodology. For the results I show, we use various methods, also in collaboration with other people. We use either quantum body methods, and this is in our group, it's the hypernetic chain Lagrange method, which is not too well known, therefore I want to say at least a few words about it. And also the generalization to time dependence, which gives you excitations. We use passing ground state and diffusion Monte Carlo simulations. And then we often combine this because Monte Carlo is very good for the ground state, but very hard to do excitations. It's the same reason why Fermi. So I will only talk about Bose results now. And for bosons, Monte Carlo is very efficient. You don't have a node problem, except if you want to look at excitations. Excitations have a node, so it's the same kind of problem that you have in fermions. And you can look at excitations also in Monte Carlo, but it's orders of magnitude more time-consuming, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, depending on how complicated your excitation structure is. Therefore, we combine Monte Carlo for the ground state with many-body theory for the excitations. And for some things, we also have used mean field, where you don't have any correlations, of course, but it's very easy. Sorry? What kind of symmetry are you thinking of? You mean translational symmetry or something like this? All you need in this combination is that you have ground state quantities like structural quantities, paired distributions, and so on. That's all that you need for then the time-dependent method, quantum many-body method. So I'm not sure exactly what you meant. Oh, okay, yes, if you know the symmetry, then it's easy, yeah. But usually you don't. Yeah, yes. But this is not the problem here. But of course it's an analytic method, so it has approximation, it's not exact. So if you get the best that we use have been tested for helium, and they work quite well there. And this is a very dense system, so I expect that they will work also here. Yes. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, maybe it wasn't clear. So we combine it, but we combine it that we first do a Monte Carlo for the ground state and then. Right, yeah. So let's go back to this two-dimensional system. So we have just these sticks in a two-dimensional plane. And for the excitations, now we use the ground state results from the DMC simulations by Gregory Astakarchik, and use the method that I will explain a little bit how it works. It's correlated basis function, Brillouin-Wigner sometimes called. And we calculate the excitations in the gas phase, not in the solid phase, but in the gas phase. And what we then usually do is to calculate this dynamic structure function. Just in words, what it does, it's the response to a perturbation that imparts a momentum k and the energy omega. That's a quantity that can be measured. Neutron scattering is the typical choice in material science. Cold gas it has been measured with spectroscopy. I mean, I think the resolution is not very good yet, but it can in principle be measured. And whenever you have a peak in this two-dimensional map, it means that you have an excitation of. If the peak is at k and a particular energy omega, that means that you have an excitation energy h bar omega with a momentum k. So how do we calculate this dynamic structure function? Let's assume we know our ground state, and we take the ground state from Monte Carlo simulations or from many-body methods. Then we make the following ansatz. So this is the ground state wave function. We make a time-dependent ansatz. This is the trivial dependence of the ground state, so we factorize this out. And then we have some, it's convenient to write it in this exponential form, exponential of this correlation function, in general a correlation operator, which depends on time. You normalize it properly. And then this delta u, that's the important thing. What do you choose here? If you keep it completely general, then of course you have to solve the general n-body problem. So you have to simplify it, and you assume that it consists of one-body parts, two-body correlations, and maybe three-body correlations. Then you invoke the time-dependent generalization of Fritz variational principle. Maybe it has its own name, I'm not sure. So this is just right without the time dependence. And time integral is just the Ritz variation principle, that the variation of the Hamiltonian average excitation value of the Hamiltonian should be zero in the ground state. For time-dependent Schrödinger equation, you have this principle. It's clearly that this is equivalent to the time-dependent Schrödinger equation. We also include a time-dependent perturbation, and the reason is that we can then use linear response theory, that which says to linear order, every perturbation of a system will also give a response. And we look at the density response. This is the density. We also go to frequency space. So this is the change of the density, which of course also depends on position. So it's just simplified writing here. And there's a linear relation to first order between the response and the perturbation. And this is called the response function or response operator. And in this case, it's the density-density response operator. So if in coordinate space, this operator is an integral operator, for example. If we come back to this correlation operator here, if you would only take into account this kind of, well, you can't call it correlations because it contains only one particle coordinate, you actually get the old Biell-Feynman approximation, which is fairly 60 years old. So. For fermions, I think then you get RPA, yes. Yeah. So it's not too hard to include two-body correlations, at least if you do some approximations. There are very obvious approximations, and they have been tried out, and you can find a review here. And then you basically account, for example, for coupling between excitations. It also improves the accuracy of your excitation energies. This has been tested, for example, helium. And since maybe 2 or 3 years, now also the three-body correlations have been included. And then essentially you get almost quantitative agreement with experiments for a strongly interacting system like helium. I mean, this has been only implemented for homogeneous systems so far. So come back now to the density-density operator. How do we get what we want, which is the dynamic structure function? It's just the imaginary part. That's the fluctuation dissipation theorem, actually. You take the imaginary part of the response function, and you get this dynamic structure function. And if you do the actual calculations of this, I mean, I wrote it only formally, so you have to do functional derivatives with respect to these correlation functions to get equations for the correlation functions and express everything in terms of density and so on. And in the end, what you obtain for a very simple system, namely a homogeneous system, is a simple expression for the dynamic structure function. This is the static structure function, which we get from the ground state calculation. This is now the homogeneous version of the Biell-Feynman spectrum. Also very simple, and probably everybody has, well, many people have seen this already. The most complicated expression is the is this sigma here, the self-energy. It's an energy-dependent quantity. And they describe coupling between modes. And I mean, for the homogeneous system, it's still, you can still write it down on a slide, so I wrote it down. So this is the expression. You see this takes care of momentum conservation. So, I mean, then you can simply integrate out one of the momenta. And you can see how the coupling works. So essentially, whenever the energy is equal to two collective modes, then you see that this denominator becomes zero. And this is how the coupling comes out of the theory. How strong the coupling is, the strength of the coupling is determined by this three phonon vertex or whatever people call it. And you can also write it down simply. I mean, if you include three-body correlations, but this is actually not very hard in an approximate way. And it does depend on that. So you see that the self-energy only depends, again, only on S of k. And S of k is the Fourier transform of the pair correlation. So everything, this whole expression really depends only on the static structure function, which you obtain directly or via Fourier transformation from the pair correlation. And you know this from the ground state calculation. So in principle, you have all the quantities that you need are there, and you just have to calculate this. In principle, it's valid for high energies, but of course you have at high energies, you may have more complicated decay processes of involving three particles, for example. And these become more important. Therefore, it's worse. I mean, it's really based on linear response, and linear response is, in principle, is not restricted to low energies, but because of the approximations here, that you, for this expression, yeah, well, if you cut here higher order terms, that's the reason why at higher energies it starts to become worse and worse. Yes, yes. Yeah, because it's kind of intuitively clear that for three-body processes that you should include three-body correlations, time-dependent, and so on. So now we have this expression, the homogeneous case at least, simple expression for the dynamic structure function that we can calculate from ground state data. And then we can analyze it. So if, for example, this, I mean, and it looks kind of similar to what we saw yesterday in Michael's talk, this expression here. Okay. But it comes from a different method. You also have an energy denominator and so on. But here, yeah, I mean, the derivation is clearly very different. So if this, if you look at the energy denominator, if this has a real solution, then this the solution omega is actually the energy of a collective excitation with infinite lifetime, because it has to be real. Well, if it has a real solution, that means that the imaginary part is zero. And you can see that if you take the imaginary part and this is only real, and you let this go to zero, you get the delta function. So it's a delta peak in your spectrum, which means infinite lifetime. If you have a solution for this expression, then and the imaginary part, the solution is small, then you have an excitation, but it's damped with finite lifetime, and it can decay into lower energy excitations. And then you would see a delta peak in your S of k and omega. If you don't, I mean, on this level approximation, maybe then higher order processes will then broaden it a little bit. And here you get the peak with a line width given by the imaginary part. I mean, you can simply see it. It's just a Lorentzian if you take the imaginary part in the vicinity of a solution. And if the imaginary part is large, then you can't really talk about excitation with a finite momentum. You get what is called a multi-excitation continuum. And there are no well-defined excitations. So this is how you can interpret now the S of k and omega. And I show you now in a simple one example for the system of aligned dipole in a plane. The density is really low still. This is again in dipolar unit, so it's a very low density. I choose one particular wave number, and you get a picture like this. So this is the energy now. You can see this as a spectrum. You see a broad peak, which means it has a short lifetime, and a very sharp peak that I actually just broadened to make it look like a peak, but it's actually just a delta here. And if you use Feynman approximation, you would get the single excitation at this energy, which is clearly wrong. Bogoliubov approximation, where for this we used essentially the two-body scattering length and plugged it into the Bogoliubov energy, you get something here. But certainly you don't get the full structure of the true structure of the dynamic structure function. So even at such a very low density, you see that the simple approximations based on basically one-body fluctuations is not appropriate. Mm-hmm. No, it looks always simple. You could fit it if there's need to do it. It always looks like this. So it's linear, that's basically the inverse of the sound velocity, and then has a peak, maybe some fluctuations, and it then goes to 1. So you, I mean, there's no, we never saw a need to fit S of K, but yes, I mean, in Monte Carlo, you, I mean, the details are a little bit more complicated because in Monte Carlo, you have a finite simulation box, which selects you a discrete set of wave numbers. But I mean, the wave number has to fit in the simulation box. It has to be in each direction, has to be a multiple of 2 pi over the size of the simulation box. Yes, you see it in the next picture. The position in energy is actually, you can relate it to this position here. And you will see it now. This is not, because this is now just for 1K, and to see the full picture, I show now the full map of S of K and omega for 4 different densities, very low and then increasing slowly to, this is already 64, which is not, it's still far from solid, but it's quite dense already. And now I will come back to your question, but let me start at low density. You see something which looks like a Bogle-Wolf spectrum, linear and then quadratic. You see already that there's a substantial broadening, which is not a surprise because you have a positive curvature in your dispersion, which allows, I mean, just kinematically allows for decay. And this is what you see. And the dots are the Feynman approximation. And then you increase the density, you see that there's a sharp dispersion branching off. I broadened it to make it visible, but this is actually has no infinite lifetime, which means it's really a delta ridge. And then you increase the density further, and you see how a roton develops. And this position is approximately the position of the peak in S of K. Because you see it in Feynman approximation, this is just K squared divided by S of K. And you see, if S of K is large, you get the minimum already in the Feynman approximation. And then the Feynman approximation is always too high at the roton minimum, and you improve on that. I mean, it's still not, I mean, if you do an exact calculation, the roton would be slightly lower even, but in this approximation that we are using here, we get already a substantial improvement from the simple Feynman estimate. And if we follow this sharp dispersion and plot it all in one plot, you see that first you see just a slight bend, and then you increase the density, and eventually at about density 4, you start to form a minimum. And if you plot it in the right units, they miraculously cross all at the same point. And it's not really completely clear to me why they should cross exactly at the same point. They have to cross in some region because if you use this scale for the momentum, then the roton should always be about the same position because it's given by the average interparticle distance, and we scale it by that. So they have to cross in some common region, but it looks really like they cross it in the same point. And that's, I don't know if it's coincidence or. And this kind of roton is now basically the same that you would see in a film of helium-4. It's a strongly correlated system. You have a very already quite dense system. The nice thing here is that in helium, you have a very limited range of densities, just because if you go to low density, the system breaks into droplets because it has an attractive part in the potential, so it wants to have form liquid droplets. If you go to very high density, then it solidifies, so you can never, in helium, you can never really follow the evolution of a roton excitation from basically a weakly interacting system, because there is no weakly interacting helium. And we now started doing the same for Fermi dipoles, where we use the Fermi version of the hypernetic chain method. So this was, I mean, this is still a quite trivial system because it's one parameter, which is the density. It's just a 1 over r to the third interaction. So, I mean, you can call it dipole interaction, but you don't even see any of the anisotropy of the dipole. So what we now did is to check, and other people are looking at this and have looked at this as well, of course, is the tilted dipole system. It's still in the two-dimensional plane. But now you assume that your polarization is not perpendicular to the plane, but slightly tilted by an angle alpha. And if you plug this into the dipole-dipole interaction, this is the interaction that you get. I mentioned it already. The system lives still on the two-dimensional plane, but now it's anisotropic. So I have a picture here. So I tilt it towards the x-axis. And this is the interaction that you get. It's along the y direction. It's the full, it's as repulsive as the perpendicular polarization, but you see that there's a valley where the interaction is weaker along the x-axis. And we strict ourselves to angles below the maximum angle, which is 35 something degrees, which is where the interaction would become negative, right? If you over tilt it, then they see each other's attractive cone of the dipole interaction. And then, of course, all kind of nasty short range physics comes in. And probably it would not be stable anyway, at least at the densities that we are interested in. So we strict ourselves for our system, really only the angles up to this maximum angle are sensible. And any region where we start to see an attractive 1 over r to the third along this direction would not make sense at high density. We have a strong repulsion in y, and we have a much weaker repulsion in x, depending on the angle that we choose. And we started doing this, now we have a two-parameter system. We have a density, and we have this angle that we can adjust. And we started doing this with an analytic many-body method, which is the ground state version of what I just had shown you. The reason is it's, in a sense, if you don't use the most advanced version of the theory, it's actually simpler than doing Monte Carlo. And it was much faster for us to study the full parameter space. And I say this also to advertise that even in the days of Monte Carlo simulations with fast computers, there's still some justification to do many-body theory instead of Monte Carlo, even for the ground state. So the way this works is, it's actually also very simple and natural. You write down an ansatz wave function for your many-body wave function, which consists of one-body functions, which you need if your system is not homogeneous. We have a homogeneous, anisotropic, but homogeneous system. So here we don't have this. And then, most important, we have these two-body functions. And usually, if you want to be really quantitative, you should also include at least three-body and maybe higher. Three bodies are still possible somehow. And it's convenient to write it in an exponential form, but that's not important here. And you see what this does. So if you just omit this two-body part, it's the same wave function that is used in the Hartree method. Simple product of one-body functions. And if you then, on top of it, you use an interaction which is just a delta function, you get the Gross-Piderewski equation. So if you drop all correlations, you get Gross-Piderewski. Clearly, in a two-dimensional system of dipoles, this doesn't work because you have a strong repulsion. So this basically takes care of all the repulsion because if you find the right F, and I will tell you how to find this, this will go to zero if the potential becomes too strong. And that's what quantum mechanics tells you, right? If two particles start to overlap with their repulsive potentials, the wave function should be zero. And having a two-body function allows you to find a good wave function which accounts for that. So it's a variational ansatz. I mean, to get exact, you have to include higher and higher and higher correlations. But it works surprisingly well also for strongly interacting systems. And this, if you have this part of the wave function is also called Jastrow-Feinberg ansatz, and also it's used extensively for Monte Carlo simulations as a trial wave function. So how do we obtain this yet unknown function? It's the same as you would derive, or when one way derive the Hartree equation or the Gross-Pilewski equation. You express your energy as a functional of either this function. What we do is we express it as a function of density, pair correlation, and triplet correlation, and then to use the Ritz variational principle for the ground state. And we say that the derivatives, functional derivatives, are always zero. So if you have only this part, that's Hartree, and this part then gives you this hypernetic chain Euler-Lagrange. This is, I didn't really write it down. Yeah. So this actually stands for hypernetic chain Euler-Lagrange. Euler-Lagrange because you optimize. And why hypernetic chain? Well, you need a relation between this f, so actually this U2s and the pair distribution function, and this you can go back to classical statistical mechanics, because maybe I skip this. So there's a relation between the pair correlation and this pair distribution and pair correlation function, and you also need the Ornstein-Czerneki relation, which I wrote down here. All that is important is that this is an almost closed system of equations. So assume that you know U2, you have to want to calculate G. You have the unknown N, but you have also this equation coming from statistical mechanics. And so you have two unknown, N and G, and you can calculate what you want. The only thing is that this B, they're called elementic diagrams. They functionals of the pair distribution function, but there is an infinite series of them. So you have to truncate this series, and this is one of the approximations that you have to make, that this B has to be approximated. And what I show is to make the most crude approximation, we just omit B. And also the three-body correlations, because in the end, if you want exact results, we then used Monte Carlo anyway, but this was only for getting results quickly and in a qualitative way. So I show now results for the paired distribution function here. So the density is quite high. Remember that solidification occurs at 290, at least in the exact calculations, Monte Carlo calculations. The angle is close to this critic maximum angle, which is in radians is 0.61. So we are close to this maximum angle of over-rotating the dipoles. And you see a pair distribution function, which basically tells you the probability to find two particles as a distance, or distance vector r. It's anisotropic, so we have to look at the distance vector. So assume that one particle is here. Then this shows the probability density to find a particle at any point in any other coordinate x, y. That's the meaning of the pair distribution function. And you see, in the strongly interacting direction, you see a lot of oscillations. And in the weakly interacting, you see a large peak, which is actually larger than this one. But then it basically trails off and quickly becomes one. If you calculate then the static structure function, which is what we need for the excitations, it's essentially just the Fourier transform of g minus 1. And then you add 1 again. So it's a function that goes to 1 at large distance. And you see, of course, we have oscillations here, and in Fourier space, the oscillation becomes a peak. And if you're used to looking at pictures of S of K, this is a very large peak. You never see this in a normal two-dimensional system, isotropic two-dimensional system. It would be solid with such a large peak. So it wouldn't be a gas-like system. But this is only strongly interacting in this one direction, which is why it allows to have this very large peak. And there's no peak, almost no peak in this weakly interacting direction. So this, the question is now, how do the excitations look like? And what happens if you increase the density? We know that for alpha equals zero, which is no tilting, it solidifies at 290, a density of 290. So what happens if we tilt the angle and increase the pressure or something? Does it become a solid? And it actually, from the title, you know that this becomes a stripe phase. Sorry. From this old 2007 papers, two calculations on Monte Carlo. You get larger peaks. I will show the exact results in a few minutes. Yeah, so what happens is, for example, this peak is way too small. It's already very strongly correlated, and we use the simplest versions of the method, and therefore this peak is much too small, and therefore we have to use Monte Carlo, or the most advanced version of this hypernetic J method. Oh, yeah, sorry, no, I didn't say. It's always zero. It's ground state calculations, and on top of it, excitations. So, yeah, and I said it here, it's only qualitative. All these peaks are not peaked enough, although they are already quite high. But before I go to Monte Carlo results, we also did a stability analysis just to get an idea what happens if you make the system denser and denser. Essentially, if you go back to here, so this, the first derivative with respect to the pair distribution function gives of the energy gives you the Euler-Lagrange equations that you solve to get the ground state quantities. So it's like, it's a minimization. So what you do, if you had only one parameter, you look, you take, this is the energy with one parameter, alpha, no, not alpha, b, then you would, by taking the derivative and setting it to zero, you get the minimum. Now the question is it a minimum or a maximum? Could also be like this. So the stability is, of course, analyzed by taking the second derivative. And this, for functionals, then is just the functional second derivative. And we have to see if this has only positive, if there's any eigenvalue which is negative. So this is a kind of Hessian, infinitely dimensional Hessian matrix. And we have to diagonalize it and find only the lowest eigenvalue, and if the lowest eigenvalue is larger than one, we are fine. And if it approaches zero, then we know that we are approaching an instability. Well, that's quite straightforward, and also nothing new. People have done this for isotropic systems decades ago. So we have this eigenvalue equation, which is simple enough to write it down in completeness. It's, remember that R is two-dimensional, so it's a quite high it's a quite large matrix, but on the other hand, it has a very, this part has a, integral has a simple structure because it looks like a convolution. So it can be done, and since we often use this imaginary time propagation, what we did is we solved this equation for the lowest eigenenergy by imaginary time propagation, and these are the results. So I plot here this lowest eigenvalue, normalized such that it's always one at zero tilting angle, so that they all start at one. And I do it for various densities, so 8 up to 256. And you see at low densities, this goes to a finite value at this maximum angle. But at the highest densities, we see that it actually seems to go to zero before that. If you extrapolate it, calculations become quite hard here. But if we would increase a little bit further, actually the ground state equations do not converge, and it's consistent with the with the fact that there are no solutions, because the eigenvalue really seems to go to zero before you reach the maximum angle. This is the associated eigenfunction, so it's an oscillation in the strongly interacting region, and all this essentially already points towards an interpretation that when we increase the angle too much at high densities, we get the stripe phase. And this is what we see in Monte Carlo. So the colleagues, basically Adrian Macia, did the Monte Carlo calculation in Barcelona. It's a passing real ground state method, which is nice because, especially in this case, because it restricts you to which phase you are simulating. So you can really have spontaneous symmetry breaking. And I show here two examples of simulations showing the pair distribution function again as a map now. This is for a gas phase simulation. So these are the densities. This is a fairly large angle, but you see that it all goes to one at large distance. So the maximum distance is eventually basically given by half the simulation box size. If you go to very high density and almost go to the maximum angle, you see that the pair distribution function has a symmetry breaking and has stripes. So it's not the density that you see, it's really the pair distribution function. So if partly one particle is sitting here, this shows the probability of finding another particle somewhere here. And you see it does not decay, so there's really a long range correlation. It means that you have a stripe phase. With the comparison with the previous qualitative calculations, I show now S of K for even a lower density than the hypernetic chain equations, and I see a much even larger peak. So it's for this density, the approximate peaks would be maybe around here, and it's really necessary to get for good agreement to do Monte Carlo. And so it's isotropic if you have no tilting angle, and so it's the same density, and you see that the peak, the static structure peaks are actually not very high. And at the same density, but larger angle, which actually means that on average, your potential is made much weaker now because it's the same strength in the y direction and it's much weaker now in the x direction. So the average potential we have now, we have made weaker, but the correlations are much increased in one particular direction, which is the strong interaction direction. And if we actually look at the statics, just look at the lowest figure maybe, for this stripe phase simulation, which forms spontaneously, so there's no trial wave function, no bias at all. It really forms spontaneously in the simulation. And if you plot the static structure function for the stripe phase, you see a huge peak. You see it's like 200, and it actually scales with the number of simulation particles in the simulations. And this always means that it's a Bragg peak. It's the essentially what you would see if you scatter a light on a crystal. That's the kind of Bragg peak that you would see in this case with the size of the crystal. And this, if it scales with the size, it tells you you're in a solid state, but it's not solid, it's only solid in one direction. You see here a snapshot from the simulation, and you can see actually the stripes in the snapshots too. We are working on that to do some more simulations to really pinpoint the full, or well, map out more completely the phase diagram. So here, this was still a gas phase actually. I mean, it's a repulsive interaction, so it's strictly speaking it's gas phase. It has a very large peak, and I'm not sure if there are already results for, I think, for even higher critical, for higher tilting angle, if this will eventually form a stripe phase. It's usually, in all the simulations, we had to go to very close to the critical, or this maximum angle, below but close. So this is almost this maximum angle, and then we clearly see the stripe phase. Well, if it's not, I mean, there's another phase too, the normal solid phase. So if you have a small angle, what you would form is just an anisotropic lattice. So you have, you increase the density and you have maybe, it's at zero tilting, you have a triangular lattice. And then you tilt in one direction and it's basically squeezes your lattice a little bit such that it's not a regular triangle. Equilateral triangle, but non-equilateral triangle. But that's still a solid, a normal solid. While this, in a small part of our parameter space, we see this stripes phase, which is only order in one direction. But the exact borders are not yet mapped out. It's not only a small part of the phase space. And the dynamic structure function for this system, you know, in the gas phase is not, of course, also depending on the tilting angle. And here we found quite interesting results. So I show you again a map of SNK and omega, or energy and wave number, for this density for three different angles. So if the angle is still small, you almost see the same. So these are the S of k. So S depends on the direction of k. So it's actually a three-dimensional cube, which I can't plot. So what I do is I show what happens if k is pointing in y or in x direction. And in between, it just varies continuously. So this is pointing in y direction, which is the strong direction. You see it in this here and here. And this is the x direction. So it's, if the angle is small, they look almost the same. You have this plateau that you have also in the isotropic case. That's called the Pitevsky plateau, which is essentially means that once you cross the energy of twice the Roton energy, everything decays. There's no there's no clear excitation anymore. Only at very high momenta you get back some damped excitations. And then we increase the angle, and maybe let's go to the largest angle. We see that now the Roton energy really goes almost to zero. And if one could do an even better calculation, it would probably go even lower, because from helium calculations, we know that this approximation still overestimates the Roton. So in fact, maybe we have now finally found a system where you can follow the Roton energy all the way down to a phase transition, which in helium or other systems was never seen. Interestingly, we also see another much weaker dispersion. It's the Roton dispersion is not damped. This one is damped. Also, it's much weaker because note that this is a logarithmic scale, so it's maybe 10 times, the spectral weight is 10 times smaller than that of the Roton. But it looks like another Roton energy. And if you remember back what I showed here for the dispersion of a solid, maybe I have to draw it a little bit smaller. So the dispersion of a solid, if you continue beyond the first Brillouin zone, looks like this. And this looks like an approximation, continuous approximation to the dispersion of a solid. So I think that's quite nice. So at the moment, everything points towards a continuous transition to a stripe phases, second order if you want. So we can really touch the zero line with our excitation, the rotons, and this one would also touch zero because this turns out to be approximately twice the energy of this. And when they all touch zero, then you have this. Yes, the normal. Right, it's only one direction. It's a stripe phase. It's not. That's probably the reason why this works here. It's not a solid. It's solid. It has long range order in one direction, but not in the other. Okay, so maybe I should speed up a little bit. We also looked now at not two-dimensional system. That's actually what we look mostly, but don't have that much time now. Using again this hypernetic chain Euler-Grand method, not Monte Carlo simulations. These are quasi two-dimensional systems. So we have pancake shaped traps, but we take the limit of an infinitely large pancake because symmetry always helps when you use analytic methods. And that kind of calculations were done already with Gross-Pitevsky equation and gave rise to different kinds of rotons, which I called Roton 2, which are not because of the repulsion, but because, according to our results, due to dimerization. But I will come to this. Weak point of what we have done here is that since this method always gives you the ground state, we have to stabilize it. So we can't really do calculations of a metastable system. And hopefully this can be improved by using a really smarter, incorporating the two-body physics of molecules in a smarter way than we did. But at the moment, we used just a repulsion to make the system repulsive at short range, and then this sigma was just a parameter. So it's not the scattering length or something. It's really a parameter. So the connection experiment is, at this stage, a bit tricky. Well, another way to say it, it's impossible. So this is the potential that we are looking at. So this is the dipole potential. So one particle is sitting here. And then another one particle is sitting here. And the repulsion comes because we also have a confinement. And in order to protect ourselves from falling into this infinitely deep well here, we have to add a repulsion. So we have this repulsion, we have a trap frequency that we can adjust, and we can have adjusted density. These are the three parameters. So there's already quite a lot of parameter space to explore. And we used the hypernetic chain method, and then also looked at excitations with the same method I presented. And of course, there are rotons, because this was already shown for Gross-Podievsky, on the Gross-Podievsky level. And these are now rotons in a dilute gas. And the rotonization, that's what they call it in this paper, is due to the attractive part of the potential. So it's not that the particles repel each other and you have this near order. You have actually, it's the attractive part that tends to destabilize a system. And this gives rise to a roton. And I show a calculation with some random, artificial parameters now, where we see that indeed we start to see a roton excitation. So this is following this is again S of k and omega. You see damping at the Podievsky limit. This is where the Podievsky plateau starts. This is the dispersion that we get. And if the system becomes unstable when you would increase the density, decrease the trap strength, and also decrease this artificial sigma parameter. That means when your system becomes, for example, wider, it can explore more of this attractive well. Basically, you reduce these barriers here from the harmonic potential that destabilizes. And that's.
So from the system becoming unstable, you set sigma to zero. Okay, otherwise the roton minimum doesn't depend on sigma?
No, it does depend. I show it now a series of calculations where I just changed sigma. So these are parameters which are kind of reasonable. I don't know if 10 kilohertz are possible, but I choose this. So erbium-2 experiments are ongoing. I think the actual dipole, magnetic dipole moment is smaller. I mean, there are various combinations of dipoles, and the largest one is maybe, I think, 11 or 12. It's not 14, but when we did this, we didn't know this. The density, I think, is maybe a little bit high, but not completely unreasonable. And then we just changed this artificial parameter that may be related to decreasing the scattering lengths, but we don't really know this. And this is the S of k and omega, so you see the dispersion here. You also see that Feynman approximation for such a very low density system is actually quite good, except that you don't get damping, which you set in here, for example. And then we just decrease this sigma, and you see how you start to see this roton excitation. For some reason, and this is not fully understood by us at least, we never can really go all the way down. Because in the Gross-Podievsky calculations, this is now this attractive roton. This is a completely different kind of roton that I talked before. it's all the, that happens already at very low density. In the Gospodevsky equations, people, the ground state calculations are always stable by definition. So you don't, even if the system doesn't exist, Gospodevsky would give you a solution. And then what they did is they did they solved the Bogolyubov-Degen equation, which are the linearized Gospodevsky equation, and then they saw if it's stable or not. And then, therefore, they could go to tube the system all the way down to zero energy for the rotor. In our case, we have our ground state calculations simply do not converge if we would go further. And I think that this is actually, there's also physics behind it, and that the system actually starts to dimerize. So there are if it dimerizes, so that means the two dipoles are on top of each other, of course, then all kinds of short-range physics comes into play, and it probably collapses. But the first step to collapse is a dimerization, according to our results, at least. I don't know. Maybe one could. I think there is a roton, and that maybe won't, if you do it very carefully. I mean, there is a little bit of a roton, right? It has a somewhat a minimum, but I'm not sure if one could really do an experiment where you can go all the way down. But of course, our model is really different from Gross-Podievsky. We have this repulsion that protects us from the ground state. You don't have to do this in Gross-Podievsky. You can get solution without any repulsion because the mean short-range interaction of the dipole interaction is zero. It's just magical. Well, you take average over the L equal 2 spherical harmonic and it's zero. So it's certainly a little bit different model. And I'm not saying that our model is the best. You can have a system where you have two kinds of rotons by just changing the trap parameter. So this is what we did here. This is a weak trap and this is a strong trap. And we just did several calculations by increasing the trap parameter. So this is basically what you just saw here with slightly different parameters. At the density of 2, and you see this barely a roton, and the question is, can it really go down? But now let's stabilize the system by making the trap tighter and tighter, and you see that this kind of roton goes away, becomes more straight, but then you increase the density further, and essentially you make the system two-dimensional. And you start to see a different kind of bending. And this is just the roton that I talked before. In a two-dimensional system at sufficiently high density, you get the roton number 1. So this is roton type 1. This should be 1, this should be 2 in my notation. So in weak trapping, you get this attractive roton. And for strong trapping, you get the repulsive roton, which are completely different physics. But you can just find both if you change the trap strength. Okay, so what we are now going also to look at bilayer systems and or maybe multilayer systems. So we have density distributions like this. This is the density profile for different parameters of our model potential. It's just a superposition of two cosine. So for example, there are two layers which are very wide but far apart, and there are very narrow layers which are close together. And let's see what I show you. Maybe I show this. And what we see is if we have wide, far apart layers, we have the instability that we just saw before. It's basically just two independent systems. If the layer is too wide, it becomes unstable. Then we bring them together, but also make them more narrow. And we again see some kind of signature that the system becomes softer again in a way. And this is now because the layers are too close together. So what you can form is dimers across the two layers. So it's an interlayer dimerization. And we see it when we look at the pair distribution function, but I think I will skip those. And here it's really the intralayer dimerization that drives this softening of the modes. Also, they are not, it's clearly not the rotum yet, but it's going in that direction. Maybe I show this also. So the question is, how do you, would you stabilize against dimerization between layers? Because in principle, you can always find bound states if you have only one dipole on an infinite plane, another one on the another infinite plane. There's always a bound state, even at large distance. It's a very weakly bound state, but there's always a bound state. So what I show here is the approximate boundary where you have dimerization for two, now it's two-dimensional layers. So here it's for large distance, this is the stable regime and this is the unstable regime where you have dimers. And you see that actually you, when you increase the density in both layers, you stabilize against dimerization. So at very high densities, you can bring the two layers very close together. But if you say you have very dilute dipoles in your setup in the experiment, then you're much more likely to form dimers. Because then maybe you are at these densities, and then already a much larger distance is enough to dimerize the system. And now we also look at multilayers, and also want to do it for tilted dipoles, which is a little bit strange because then the interaction is not just anisotropic, but also has no inversion symmetry across two layers. And just a few words about rotating dipoles. So for example, we estimated with a simple Gross-Piderski calculation, what is the effect of rotation on a dilute gas of say this density. I mean, this is for atomic densities. This is not a problem, of course, for molecules. I think it's, I don't know if they will ever reach this. And we see that there's for the J equal 1 state, you get the splitting of the J equal 1 state. And if I plug in this number, it's about 1.6 megahertz. And I don't know if this can be measured because it's on top of a very large rotational constant, which is on the gigahertz range. But there should be a splitting of 1.6 megahertz approximately. And we have also looked, Brenton mostly has looked at Monte Carlo simulations. This was an earlier one where we looked at just an artificial one-dimensional lattice. And so what happens if you decrease the lattice contents to very low values? These are much lower than optical lattices. So it's not yet, at least in any is not yet achievable. And then we plot here the polarization. And you see that you have a spontaneous polarization because simply that the dipoles start to line up head to tail on the lattice if you bring it very close together. And as I mentioned in the beginning, we want to look at self-assembled crystalline phases. And if there is any effect of rotation during this workshop, I was also starting to be interested if there's anything interesting in the three-body physics if you have rotating dipoles. I mean, we heard in your talk you looked at aligned dipoles, and I don't know, maybe again the effect is small, but and maybe in the future also look at ions in dipolar gases because then the interactions are really strong, even at very dilute dipolar gases. There should be an effect of polarization towards the ions. And these are the people who were involved. Brenton is here. And he's doing the Parsinger Monte Carlo simulations with rotations. And I also want to acknowledge where the money came from, mostly from a grant, Austrian National Science Fund. Okay, thank you. We haven't looked at this yet. This is also something we want to look at, also the condensate fraction. So these are all things that we have not done yet. I mean, superfluid is probably anisotropic, but I don't really understand what it means, anisotropic superfluid. I mean, people have looked at this effect on the Gross-Bedievsky level, actually, looking at not the superfluid fraction, but I think somehow the superfluid response to a perturbation in a dipolar gas with tilted polarization. And if you perturb it in one or the other direction. And they have looked at the mean field level and saw that, of course, it's different. The response is different. But I don't know what the details are, what they got. I can send you the reference. Sorry? These are density stripes. So you spontaneously form these density stripes, yes. But even here, you see some stripiness, but it's not long range yet. But probably here too, the superfluid response in this and in this direction should be different, I would assume. Although it's still a homogeneous gas. The attraction, yes. Yeah. Well, for the attractive roton, according to our calculations, what happens if you make the system even more unstable, it forms a dimer phase, where two dipoles are bound head to tail. And well, this is probably, if this would be stable if you're in two layers, because then you can safely make a dimer state, and many people have looked at this already. And that's quite different from what happens if you make the system, a repulsive system, denser and denser, and it solidifies, because the repulsive roton is more like a signature of soon becoming solid. So the physics is, I would say, completely different of these two rotons. They just happen to have the same minimum at finite wave number, and also the wave number, how it scales, is different. One scales with the parallel interparticle distance, and other the one with the attractive photon scales with the harmonic oscillator length. Is not included, because the theory works only for infinitely large systems. So I started doing this here to use a similar method. It's again, I mean, this is the theory is basically a variational method. So you make an ansatz for the wave function and you try to optimize it completely by doing a functional optimization rather than turning a few parameters. And you can make the same kind of ansatz of pair functions for three bodies. And somehow somebody must have done this, but. Oh, no, no. This was really three. What I mentioned here at the end was during many of these talks, I got interested in three body physics of three bodies. I mean, really just FMOS physics and so on. It just means that you take the full Hamiltonian, including the rotational degrees of freedom,
I see.
Instead of aligned one that José looked at already. And of course, if they are never come close together and always depends on the size of the FMOS state. No, no, no. This is by rotating, I really mean there's no field at all. So if they're far apart, If they're far apart, yes, but not if. sometimes the, I mean, there's a finite probability to also be close together. And I don't know if this effect is large, but.
So basically in that sense of connectivity.
Yes. Yeah. Sorry? What fraction of? You mean what? What is the, I mean, it depends on the size of the Efimov state, how close there we can get. I don't know what is the typical size. I mean, this was just an idea I had while I made the talk. I did not really start, I mean, really do the calculation, but. Yeah. To how large? I mean, if the Efimov states are 200 nanometers large, then this is not important. I mean, if they say the particles are most of the time further than 50 nanometers apart in the Efimov state, and I don't know what size of Efimov states actually have, then it will not play a role. But of course, I mean, once you bring them closer together, but if you don't have an average dipole, if you just have an Efimov state of point-like particles, then what is the size of an Efimov state? It's not that large, no? What is? Who knows of van der Waal length? A number? 100 Bohr, so it's 5 nanometers, no? No, 20. That's 155 nanometers. That's quite close. I mean, I would say that dipoles, I mean, can see the full 1/3 interaction at 5 nanometers, no? I don't think that average is simply out. They will start to polarize each other in some way. Okay, maybe. I'm out of my own field too much. Well, the question is, for example, all this universal scaling, is it still true? If you have internal degrees of freedom, like rotations. But I'm really So I shouldn't have put this up because I'm not really a female physicist, so probably leads to more confusion than I can. What components do you mean? Well, it's oh yeah. It's like one. That's what I basically meant, but maybe saying in different words. I mean, if you don't have an external field and they're far apart, they are in the S state. If you bring them very close together, much closer than in cold gases, they will just form like a stick of oriented dipoles. Now the question is, if FMO states are in the size of 5 nanometers, is this close enough to actually, they basically polarize each other. And that's no. I mean, are you talking about three body calculations or this? This one or? This in general. Well, it's a single component Bose system of particles with rotational degrees of freedom. I mean, I don't know, it's a single component process. Probably I should have put it differently. Yes, if you say that these are the components, then it's an infinite component system because I contain, but it's not different species of particles. I thought this, you mean different particle species, like two different kinds of molecules. You mean the?
So what I'm asking, what physically does that mean? What does the gas do in the Wolfram minimum, or if it has one?
Well, for example, if you have a minimum, you have a divergent density of states. That's how it actually was detected. So you have at the heat capacity, you can see an effect of this very large density of states at a particular energy. And people originally thought that's a rotation, actually. That's why it's called roton. It's not a rotation. But they thought there's a rotational excitations of several helium atoms in a circle, and which has a finite energy. And this is actually a continuum of states, but with a minimum, which means it looks like a particular state, because it has such high density of states. And in the heat capacity of helium, one can see it, and one would also see it here. Yes, for this argument, all that matters, it's a high density of states. And
if you get this very high density, even if you have a relatively flat minimum, like the most that you get, I mean, your minimum.
Yes, because the density of states is 1 over the derivative of the dispersion and some factors, but and once it becomes flat, you have essentially a divergence.
Yeah.
And then if it's flat, you have one divergence, and if you have a minimum and a maximum, then you have two divergent parts. But
if you could detect them
No, I think in Innsbruck they want to measure it with spectroscopy in erbium. So they really want to. I also proposed, well, maybe one can see this high density state if this is maybe simpler. But I think they really want to map out the dispersions. And for that, you need really momentum resolved measurements.
Thank you again.
Thank you.